thanks for turning on The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Daisy Sindelar, a writer at RFERL, and I'll be your host this week. Coming up in episode 17 of The Blender.
The death of bin Laden marks the most significant achievement to date in our nation's effort to defeat al-Qaeda.
The killing of Osama bin Laden reignites the debate over torture, with some Americans now arguing his demise proves that coercive interrogation is the only way to win the war on terror.
You know, if you leave the guy a light on in the guy's cell, that's torture, and you can't do it no matter how many lives are at stake. I just think that's no way to fight a war.
We also look at the lives of Iraq's garbage pickers, men, women, and children forced to sift through garbage dumps in Baghdad to eke out a living.
We have no other work. We have tried to apply for jobs, but there is nothing. To get a decent job, you have to pay a bribe or know someone in government who can help you. I don't have money for that. What can I do? Find money for a bribe in the garbage?
But first, to the event that dominated the world's news this week, the detection and killing of al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden in a special U.S. military operation in Pakistan. The killing brings closure to a nearly decade-long search for the elusive Saudi-born terrorist who has been behind some of the world's worst terrorist attacks, including the 2004 Madrid bombings and the 9/11 attacks on the United States. But bin Laden's demise has also given rise to a host of new questions on everything from the U.S. decision not to release photographs of the slain al-Qaeda leader to the role Pakistan played as bin Laden's witting or unwitting host. To explore some of those issues, correspondent Ron Sinovitz sat down with Mohammed Amin Mudakik, a senior editor with Radio Free Europe's Afghan service, and correspondent Abubakar Siddiq, a native of Pakistan.
We're here in the studio with Abubakar Siddiq, a senior correspondent in the central newsroom of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, who is from the Afghanistan-Pakistan border region and who's been reporting for more than a decade on Pakistan and Afghan affairs. And Amin Mudakik, who is from Mazar-i-Sharif in northern Afghanistan. He is a senior editor of Radio Azadi, the Afghanistan service of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. U.S. President Barack Obama has announced that he is not going to release photographs of Osama bin Laden that were taken after he was killed by U.S. Special Forces. I'd like to start with you, Mr. Mudakik. If you could please tell us, in the context of how those photographs would be received by people in Afghanistan, is that a good idea or a bad idea to hold the photos and not release them?
Sanctioning the photos may have been a good idea in short term because this could prevent any kind of provocation. But in the long term, it's not a good idea not to release photos. We all know that there are few people in Afghanistan who are supporter or sympathizer of bin Laden. Quite a large number of Afghans do not support him. In fact, they think that bin Laden was the main source of their miseries. All the bad things which happened in Afghanistan. They know that bin Laden misused the Afghan hospitality. They know that bin Laden caused rift between different tribes of Afghans. He always sided with one tribe to attack another tribe. He always misused his money and his resources to create a division among Afghans. If the photo is released, there will be a sigh of relief among most of the Afghans that bin Laden is gone. So a kind of ambiguity which still exists among Afghans will be gone. They will be determined and work with more dedication to start talking to the Taliban and to start thinking about the future course in the peace efforts. Particularly those who are involved in the peace efforts will be more emboldened, will be more encouraged to go ahead with the mission. But if the photo is not there, they will be still afraid that bin Laden is alive or make them suspicious.
And Abubakar Siddiq, what are your thoughts? The people in Pakistan in particular, where you're from, there seems to be almost a what some have called a culture of conspiracy theories in Pakistan, that Osama bin Laden is not really dead, that this is a fabricated story by Washington.
I think releasing his photograph or holding his photograph will not change the facts. And for as we know and we understand, the fact is that bin Laden is dead. If we go to the recent past, the gruesome pictures of Saddam Hussein being hanged, of Saddam Hussein being captured, didn't really serve any international interest. It created some backlash. It gave al-Qaeda and all sorts of extremists. It reinvigorated their propaganda campaigns. But at the same time, my journalistic instinct tells me that at some point these pictures might be leaked. Then it will be kind of a complicated situation to handle for the administration.
In the United States, many fingers are being pointed at Islamabad because, in essence, Osama bin Laden was hiding in a compound very close to a major military academy in Pakistan. Sarah Palin has said that there are an awful lot of questions that Pakistani leaders need to answer. U.S. Congressman Dana Rohrabacher, a Republican from California, is very angry about the fact that Osama bin Laden has harbored in Pakistan. He has said that Pakistan is a country being run by radical Islamists. He said they've lied, and lied again. They've played us for suckers, meaning the United States. He's suggesting that all aid to Pakistan should be cut and that Washington should withdraw from its strategic alliance and team up with another country in the region other than Pakistan, for example, India.
It's not a simple question to answer, but I think that both the Pakistani policymakers and the Americans realize that they have to somehow make this relationship work. What makes it very different from other post-colonial countries or third world countries is that it's too big to fail. We don't have in the world yet a precedent of a nuclear-armed country failing or failed nuclear state. And of course, Pakistan then has its own regional alliances, a very close relationship with Beijing, with China. And I think at this point in time, it's in the best national interest of Pakistan. It's also in the best national interest of the West. NATO is still dependent on more than 80% of its supplies in Afghanistan through Pakistan. Pakistan remains relevant and, in fact, one of the central players in the endgame around Afghanistan. If sanity prevails, I think it will eventually smooth out. There will be adjustments, but it will probably work.
Amin Mudikek, you mentioned before that the death of Osama bin Laden could provide an opportunity to push forward with some kind of talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government. Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai has also said now is the time to push forward on peace talks.
If you look at the Taliban reaction to this death, it seems that they don't want any strong alliance with Al-Qaeda. Low-rank Taliban are fed up with the fighting. They don't want the continuation of this. They just look for reasons to tell their leadership that this fight will go nowhere. And I believe this is a good opportunity. The call which President Karzai made could be expanded, could be strengthened. This message should go to the Taliban leadership in full force and reinforce to the middle Taliban leadership that if Pakistani are not loyal to bin Laden, if Pakistani could not protect bin Laden in the most secure area of Pakistan, close to the Pakistani capital, then they could not protect the Quetta Shura and Mullah Omar and the whole Taliban leadership. If that message is strengthened, that this day will come to you soon, that this is not an Islamic war, this is not a jihad, this is a war of politics. People sell their partners for their own interest so you could be sold out. And I think the peace process will get more momentum. It will make their task much easier to convince the low-level Taliban leaders, the mid-level Taliban leaders, to come to the negotiation table.
That was RFERL's Mohammed Amin Mudakik and Abubakar Siddiq talking to Ron Sinovitz about the aftermath of the killing of Osama bin Laden. For more coverage of the death of bin Laden, go to our website at rferl.org.
З вами Радіо Свобода.
Ви Радіо Фарда гуще.
Айче Радіо Європа.
Машал Радіо.
Азатліть Радіосе.
Азатліцюн ГТМ.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
In the United States, the capture and killing of Osama bin Laden has resurrected the age-old question of whether the end justifies the means. More precisely, people are debating whether information obtained during so-called enhanced interrogation, introduced under the Bush administration, was a critical part of the intelligence trail that led to bin Laden nearly a decade later. U.S. officials revealed this week that two high-value al-Qaeda suspects, 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the operations chief who followed him, Abu Faraj al-Libi, gave information, some as early as 2003, that ultimately helped investigators identify a key bin Laden courier and finally track down bin Laden himself. Both Mohammed and al-Libi had been subjected to coercive interrogation methods conducted at so-called black sites, secret CIA prisons in Eastern Europe. And Mohammed notoriously endured 183 episodes of waterboarding, the simulated drowning technique that came to represent the heart of the debate over interrogation methods and torture. It's not certain, though, that either Mohammed or al-Libi gave up important information as a direct result of coercive interrogation. Martin Scheinin, the UN Special Rapporteur on Rights and Counterterrorism, says he believes it was traditional interrogation methods and not torture that provided the critical information.
This case proves that the physical means of interrogation, waterboarding, and other forms of torture did not produce the crucial pieces of evidence. I think it has been confirmed by now that the information was obtained by normal professional means of interrogation. The United States, under the Bush administration, certainly made it easier for many other countries to openly justify the opinion that torture sometimes is permissible. But I think the long-term effect is the opposite, in the sense that it turns out that actually it was normal professional methods of interrogation that gradually brought the information which was crucial, not the torture methods.
But many supporters of the Bush administration's interrogation policy see bin Laden's demise as justifying harsher tactics like waterboarding, prolonged sleep deprivation, and shackling in stress positions. Many of those techniques were regularly practiced at black sites and the U.S. military base at Guantanamo Bay before Barack Obama prohibited them when he came to office in 2009. John Yoo, the former Justice Department official who in 2002 wrote the so-called torture memos, making the case for using mental and physical torment in terrorist interrogations, this week praised the Bush administration's intelligence architecture for, quote, marking a path to bin Laden's door. And Bush's vice president, Dick Cheney, said the successful capture and killing of bin Laden proves the U.S. should restore enhanced interrogation. But critics like Andrea Prassow, the Senior Counterterrorism Council for Human Rights Watch, says such arguments are not only immoral, they simply don't hold up.
Well, Dick Cheney obviously has an incentive, both for history's sake and for his own personal liability's sake, to try to explain that he thinks the abusive and entirely illegal interrogation system that took place for many years in the Bush administration was, in fact, something that the U.S. should be proud of. I think there's no evidence of that. In fact, the evidence is to the contrary, that there are so many times when the U.S. obtained false information. I mean, we have to look only look to this very CIA program that is in question, where the U.S. extracted information that Colin Powell used in justifying invading Iraq when he went to the United Nations, information that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, that we subsequently learned was entirely false, that a detainee provided because he was being tortured, and he told his interrogators whatever he thought they wanted to hear.
Still, the killing of bin Laden, the world's most wanted terrorist, is likely to revive the debate over the merits of coercive interrogation. Nearly a decade has passed without a major terrorist attack on U.S. soil. But the threat of a fresh incident, the so-called ticking time bomb scenario, could restore arguments in some quarters that no form of interrogation is off limits when innocent lives are at stake. Clifford May, the president of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a conservative Washington think tank, says there should be clear standards for interrogation, but that different standards should apply for different situations, including harsher methods for high-value terrorists.
One thing you could do is you could have a list of techniques that experience teaches you are effective. And the president could say, okay, these are the list of effective. Five of them I'm going to cross out. There are no circumstances whatsoever that I would authorize their use. Then there are five here that, if you want me to use them, you have to make the case to me that it's absolutely essential, lives are at stake, and I may authorize them. And then there's a group where, I don't know, the DNI or the Secretary of Defense, I could say, has to authorize them, and here's what the CIA can do under any circumstances, and here's what the military can do under any circumstances. I mean, that would seem to me to be a coherent approach to this problem, as opposed to saying anything goes, which I don't think one should, but I don't think the Bush administration did, or saying nothing goes. You know, if you leave the guy a light on in the guy's cell, that's torture, and you can't do it no matter how many lives are at stake. I just think that's no way to fight a war. We've never fought a war that way, and you will not successfully prosecute a war that way.
The Obama administration, meanwhile, has shown no signs of revisiting its interrogation policies. Officials note that it took years of work and thousands of pieces of intelligence the vast majority obtained through traditional methods, to track down bin Laden. But with the future of the al-Qaeda terrorist threat still uncertain, the debate on torture appears far from over. Just a reminder that The Blender is the new weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which brings radio, internet, and television news programming to 21 countries across the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, and the Balkans. We'd love to hear from you how we're doing, so drop us a line at podcast@rferl.org or by leaving a comment on the Blender section of our website. And remember, you can download episodes of The Blender from our website or by subscribing on iTunes. A new episode is posted every Friday. Osama bin Laden's September 11th attacks on the United States prompted the U.S. to launch a still unfinished war in Afghanistan. In 2003, the U.S. invaded a second country, Iraq, in a bid to oust dictator Saddam Hussein, whom the Bush administration accused of harboring weapons of mass destruction. 8 years later, Iraq is a functioning, if somewhat wobbly, parliamentary democracy, but many of its people are mired in desperate poverty. Nikolai Pavlov reports on Baghdad's growing numbers of garbage pickers.
It's the beginning of another grueling day of work at this dump on the outskirts of Baghdad. As soon as the garbage trucks arrive, dozens of men, women and children sift through the junk in search of anything of value. Old appliances, scrap metal and empty cans and bottles can be sold to a middleman for a few dinars. It's barely enough for the garbage pickers to survive on each day, but they say there's no alternative.
We have no other work. We have tried to apply for jobs, but there is nothing. To get a decent job, you have to pay a bribe or know someone in government who can help you. I don't have money for that. What can I do? Find money for a bribe in the garbage?
Some of the workers here are migrants, mainly from the south, who came to the capital in search of jobs that never materialized. Others are Baghdadis whose families have lost breadwinners during years of war. Some are children who have given up school to help support their families.
We come here to the garbage dump in order to make a living. We have no other source of income. I wasn't able to finish school. I wish I could have done that instead.
Some 23% of Iraqis are thought to be living below the poverty line, earning less than $2 a day. That includes many working poor, like those who have turned to this desperate and uncertain work at the dump. The situation fosters growing resentment, and many blame the government for failing to provide decent jobs and living conditions.
Government officials are corrupt and preoccupied only with their personal interests. They don't care about us. They have left us to wander around the dump. I'm 23 years old, and I sell garbage for a living. Look at my appearance. Look at my hands. I look like a mangy dog.
For these Iraqis, the vast potential of the country's oil reserves is no more than a distant obstruction. They're left to search for anything that will help them survive for another day.
That was Nikolai Pavlov on the plight of poverty-stricken Iraqis in the capital, Baghdad. The story was based on reporting by Haider Rashid of RFERL's Iraqi Language Service. To see a video about Iraq's garbage pickers, visit our website at rferl.org. You're listening to The Blender, RFERL's new weekly podcast. And now it's time for Uncovered, a segment that looks at some of the under-the-radar stories coming out of RFERL's broadcast countries. Joining me in the studio are editors Merhat Sharapjan and Pete Baumgartner, who spend their days, and it must be said, some of their nights, working with our regional broadcasters to produce these underreported stories. So welcome, gentlemen. Who wants to start?
Well, I probably can start, start with a very... A worrisome story, which took place on Wednesday, the 4th of May, on the Polish-Belarusian border. A well-known Belarusian opposition activist, Alexander Lukin, who's been in France for several weeks now, decided to go back to Belarus with his wife and two kids. And then in the Belarusian border, he felt that Belarusian border guards were spending too much time researching his documents. He decided to go back to the Polish territory, and there was some kind of incident. The Belarusian police tried to catch him. They caught him and then beat him and tore his clothes. And the Polish border guards got involved and asked questions. And then when they learned that it might be a politically motivated incident, they didn't allow Belarusian border guards to keep Lukin on Belarusian territory. But unfortunately, his wife, Alena, had to return to Belarusian territory, to the Belarusian side of the border, because their two underage kids were remaining there.
What do we know about his wife now?
Oh, his wife was later fined and told that it was not necessary for her husband to run away. She seems to be fine. She talked to our Belarusian service today, on Thursday, and she must be fine now.
Has she been in contact with her husband?
That we don't know. The only thing she knows is that her husband is on his way to France right now.
This, of course, comes at a time when, unfortunately, this story is being played out seemingly over and over. There was the case of the presidential candidate Aleš Mikhailovich, who also left Belarus under pretty stressful circumstances and is now seeking asylum, I believe, in the Czech Republic. And, of course, it comes at a time when a lot of former presidential candidates are facing trial.
Yeah, and Lukin was one of the active members of the election campaigners or campaigning team for Sannikov, who's facing trial right now.
Right. Sannikov's trial started last week, and then we also have two other presidential candidates, Vladimir Nikolaev and Vital Rimoshevsky, whose trial started today.
That's right.
Okay, well, let's move on to another story. This one comes from Moldova. Pete.
Yeah, the small Muslim community in Moldova is upset because of some very what they deem to be anti-Islamic comments made by politicians there. It all started when the Islamic League of Moldova was registered. It had been trying for 3 years to get registered. It's finally been registered. And after that took place, there was a comment made by Metropolitan Vladimir, who's head of the Orthodox Church in Moldova, and he said it was a humiliation for Moldova's Christians that this took place. And then later, the former president, Vladimir Voronin, who was just president a little more than a year ago, he also said that he condemned the registration and said it was disgraceful. And he then went back a few centuries into history and pointed out that Moldova resisted the construction of mosques during the Ottoman Empire era and should do the same today. So the head of Islamic League in Moldova, a guy named Sergio Socirca, he voiced his disappointment and extreme concern with these remarks that were made. The Muslim community in Moldova, incidentally, is only about 2,000 people officially, although Socirca says that they have about 17,000 members.
And who are the Muslims? Where are they? Native Moldovans? Where do they come from?
Probably a mix of natives, and also probably Christians who perhaps changed their religion to became Muslims, either maybe perhaps a lot of ones that served in the Soviet army, particularly in Afghanistan, apparently changed their religion while they were there and came back and continued practicing Muslims. So that's probably a mix of natives and also people who have converted.
Okay, well, let's move on to Central Asia. We're going to take a look at a story from Kazakhstan. And Merhad, it looks like the Kazakh president, Nursultan Nazarbayev, a man known for big plans, has another big plan.
Yeah, that's his big plan. We can be called new, old, new big plan. Talking at the fourth economic forum in Astana, at the opening ceremony, he said that it's time to start working on the roadmap to establish a new international currency. He called current international currency, he didn't name any currency, but he said the system we have now is defected and doesn't allow further development. We need, as an international community, to establish a new currency which could unite all the economies and could protect the economies and national reserves from collapses and some other problems we're facing now.
And this is not the first time he's had this idea.
It's not the first time. He raised this issue in 2009, again in Astana, again in the Economic Forum. He proposed first a single currency for the member states of so-called Eurasian Economic Community, consisting of Belarus, Russia, Kazakhstan, and some other former Soviet republics, and saying that this is non-cash, single currency should be called Evraz or Evrazi, referring to Eurasia. And again, he had the same rhetoric and said that we have to protect ourselves from international financial crises. We have to have our own currency, which in future can be transformed to a wider international currency called Akmetal. He said this word is a combination of two Greek words, meaning Akme and capital. And so far, nobody supported this idea. Only Vladimir Putin, the Prime Minister of Russia, and some Chinese officials. A couple of times they said that that was a good idea.
Thanks, Merkat. It'll be interesting to see whose picture he wants to put on the new bills once they're made. Okay, it's springtime, so it's time to talk about weddings, and there's an interesting story coming out of Kyrgyzstan. Pete.
Yeah, the Kyrgyz Youth Ministry just announced that it's going to pay for a giant wedding reception this Saturday for 20 young couples that have very low incomes and said that they were unable to afford a big wedding. And in Kyrgyzstan, as well as the rest of Central Asia, having a big wedding, or even more so a big wedding party afterwards, is a huge thing. It's just a standard practice. And a wedding party can go on for 2 or 3 days. You have instances of people taking out huge loans, selling their worldly possessions in order to have a huge, successful party. They compete with each other, and it's really a big thing. So the fact that the government has decided to help out these poor people is really an interesting thing to do.
Now, you were saying that weddings are not only a matter of neighborly rivalries and things like that, but the gifts that people have to give and the dowries that the groom has to provide can be just phenomenal. Can you give some examples of some of the things people have
to give? Well, people give livestock, or they buy large amounts of furniture for the new couple, but these things cost thousands of dollars. You could even buy a car, for instance, to try to pay the dowry, but you're definitely expected, the groom is definitely expected to give ample gifts to the bride's family.
So this is probably a pretty popular proposal.
Yes, I think it is, and I'm actually worried that they're going to be overwhelmed with requests because they're saying they're going to do it every year.
Well, I hope they start saving up.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's all we've got time for this week. I want to thank editors Pete Baumgartner and Merkat Sharpjian, as well as our producers Jan Kaiser and Tanya Kancheva. I'm Daisy Sindelar, and thanks for turning on the blender. We'll see you next week.